It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just you today?
Yeah, it's just me today. Job is out of town. He's taking a little trip, doing some speaking, and having a good time. So,
as good a time as you can have in Memphis.
Yeah.
I think you can have a pretty good time, based
you
on
can
what I've
if
heard.
You want. So. Yeah.
All right. Well, should also let people know that we will try and make time at the end for questions that you have for Maria. We got one left over from last week, so we're going to squeeze that in at the
end.
Yeah,
and try to remember that I only have a couple of minutes in which to answer them, so try to make them short and brief.
But you can do that via email at dj@kexp.org. And you can always also put them in the hopper at our public affairs phone line, 206-520-5838. So, well, one of the things we will start with is there's an update on Pritchard Beach.
Yeah, we've talked about this the last one or two times we were in here in the studio, that there were activists folks in South Seattle who wanted to get the city to not cut funds for lifeguards at Pritchard Beach. That had been part of the mayor's plan for the budget. And the Seattle City Council has come through for them. The council's finance committee has decided to allocate $40,000 to restore the lifeguards at Pritchard Beach in response to neighborhood activists' requests that they do so. And they're going to vote. The full council gets to vote on this measure on Monday. So neighborhood activists are asking folks to send emails in support and to say thank you to McIver, Lakota Conlon, and Della for supporting this measure. So if you send emails to other city council members, too, it'll have a better chance of passing.
That's right, because that's only like 4 of 9 right there.
Right, they need another vote. So I think they'll probably get one, but it'd be good to let people know that you care about this thing.
Especially with summer just about here. It's important to get those lifeguards out there.
That's right.
All right, and moving along, the logging this week had a decision that doesn't look so good for the trees.
Well, way back when Bill Clinton left office, if you can remember back that far, he had signed in the last days when he was in office, he had finally signed into law and had hoped to put into place a federal rule to declare some areas of national parks, national forests as roadless areas, to designate them as roadless areas, which would have put them off limits to logging. Environmentalists hailed that. Some of them scratched their heads and said, yeah, it's an easy decision to make just as you're leaving office. And sure enough, as soon as George Bush took power, he immediately put that rule on hold. He immediately suspended that rule. And it's been through the courts. The Ninth Circuit Court has declared that the government should adhere to that rule. Environmental activists brought a suit saying that the government should adhere to the rule. And the Tenth Circuit Court is currently hearing a case on it. But the Bush administration, the federal government, has just issued a new federal rule that pretty much suspends the roadless area designation. And what it does is it puts the decision in the hands of local governors, gives them an 18-month period in which to decide how they want to treat the national forests in their state. And the interesting thing about this is that the bulk of the property, the bulk of the forest that will be subjected to this change in rules are in 12 western states, and the largest tracts of land are in Alaska and Idaho, which both have Republican governors. So you can guess which way their governors are going to lean towards more logging, obviously, and more roads. There are other large tracts of land in Colorado, California, Utah, and Nevada, those states also have Republican governors. Now, here in the state of Washington, there's about 2 million acres. Governor Christine Gregoire has said that she's going to try to protect that land, but the ultimate decision lies with the local land management folks within the National Forest Service locally. They make the final decision, and if Governor Gregoire is as vulnerable to logging interests as Governor Locke was, well, it could be pretty hard for her to hold the line against them. Now, it's certainly that this kind of a question isn't even going to come up in the places with the largest tracts of land. Alaska has far more than 2 million acres that are going to be subjected to the change in rule. They've got more like 15 million acres. In Idaho, something like 9.5. Those guys are probably going to just immediately make the decision that, yeah, the roadless rules don't apply here and logging interests can have their way. So that's something that that environmentalists are going to be trying to tie up in court and that local activists should be getting on the bandwagon about.
All right. Well, moving to a little more international, Colombia, a country that has got a lot of conflicts that the U.S. has been involved with indirectly, and now it sounds directly.
It's our other war, the war we're not talking about, you know, other than Afghanistan and Iraq, which, by the way, both of those wars are still going on, even though you might not think so. Particularly the war in Afghanistan is still going on, even though we don't hear anything about it. And the war in Colombia is still churning away with 600 to 800 U.S. military personnel down there at any one time, supposedly helping the Colombia government to fight what is pretty much a civil war. This past week, you might have seen a little bitty article hidden in, I saw it in the PI, it might have been also in the Seattle Times, that the government of Colombia arrested two U.S. soldiers who they had found were trying to traffic arms to right-wing paramilitaries. The interesting thing is that they caught these two U.S. soldiers with ammunition and weapons that had been paid for with U.S. tax dollars that were part of the Plan Colombia money, part of the U.S. Plan Colombia money that's supposed to go for weapons and training for the Colombian military. Instead, these guys were meeting in a house with a former Colombian policeman who has ties to the right-wing paramilitaries, and it was obvious there was a deal going down to send weapons over to the right-wing paramilitaries. This comes just after the U.S. had arrested a couple of U.S. soldiers for returning to the United States in a plane from Colombia with cocaine. So what we have here is we have all the makings of what looks like another sort of Iran-Contra deal, trafficking weapons down to right-wing paramilitaries, bringing back cocaine as payment. So, I mean, that's we have the pieces in place. What we need is truly investigative journalism and some FOIA requests to try to get some of that information out of the Bush administration.
It's not hard to believe, seeing that most of the people who were involved in Iran-Contra happened to be in the administration, brought back in this particular administration.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not hard to believe, given the guys in power are some of the same guys who were in power back then during the Iran-Contra scandal, that we might see the same thing now. But it's all happening under the radar. We don't even get the daily wire service articles anymore about what's going on in Colombia like we do about what's going on in Iraq. So it's really, really hard to know how the war is progressing, what's going on, and the Bush administration carry on this thing under the radar.
And yet, if I remember correctly, Colombia is like the fifth largest recipient of U.S. Weapons and military funding?
I thought it was the fourth, behind behind Iraq, Afghanistan, and Israel, but it might be the fifth.
All right. Well,
might be somebody else in there who's jumped ahead. But Plan Colombia is a massive amount of money going down to fight, essentially arm one side in a civil war.
All right.
Oh, and I should probably also mention too that everywhere, you know, in the U.S. media, in the news, in our popular culture, there's this notion that it's the left wing guerrillas in Colombia who are the drug traffickers. Nobody ever cites any statistics, any reports as proof of this. And it's kind of interesting that when you do actually look at the reports and the statistics, you see often that much of the coca growing, and particularly the coca trafficking that's sold abroad, for the cocaine that's sold abroad or shipped abroad, is coming out of the northern part of the country, which is still under control of right-wing landowners and right-wing paramilitary death squads. So I don't think we should just always assume that it's the left-wing guerrillas who are the drug runners in this war. We should at least assume that it's both sides.
Very good. All right, well, moving along and sticking with international, then that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
A lot of the headlines this week in Iraq had to do with Private Lindy England and the Abu Ghraib scandal and how her guilty plea was dismissed by a judge, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to talk about that because that's not the real news in Iraq. I think the number one headline in Iraq should have been this week, should have been on the front page, and it should have been Bush lied. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the release of a classified British memo that reports on a visit to Washington, D.C. by the head of Britain's intelligence agency, MI6. This visit occurred on July 23rd, 2002. That was 3 months before the U.S. government had completed its national intelligence estimate on Iraq that supposedly said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and was a threat to the world, if not to U.S. interests. This memo... on this visit in July of 2002, asserts that George Bush had already made up his mind to go to war with Iraq, and his advisors, Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice, were just looking around for a way to make it happen. So George Bush, contrary to what he was saying at the time, had already made up his mind he was going to go to war, and they were going to just try to find a way to do it. There's actually a quote out of the memo that I find very interesting, or part of a sentence. It goes, quote, "The intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy," end quote. That says it pretty clearly, that they were just looking for intelligence that would support a means to go to war. This is something that some of us on the left had already suspected at the time, and that we know now that much of the American public is still somehow under a haze that we went to war for particular reasons, for example, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or because Iraq was a threat, when in fact we didn't. We went to war simply because George Bush wanted to. And that's what this memo shows very clearly. And it's also interesting, too, that this comes in the wake of other memos released by the, you know, kind of leaked from the British government or released by the British government, that shows that Tony Blair also lied to his cabinet when he said that that they were pursuing every means possible through the UN to try to get Iraq to come to a diplomatic, agreement with the U.S. for inspectors, etc., when in fact Tony Blair was on the bandwagon almost immediately wanting to go to war with Iraq and trying to help the United States find a way by massaging the intelligence and figuring out some way to make it look like it was okay to attack another country and depose its leader. This is just confirmation of what we know, but it should be big headlines in the U.S. It should be the lead story. It's not.
Another thing I found interesting out of the memo was in that same paragraph you were just quoting, them saying there was little discussion in Washington of the aftermath after military action, which is what you've been saying.
Yeah, no,
saying
that's
the whole
that's
time.
Come out a lot. I mean, that's something also that should be big news too, but it hasn't been. But it comes out here and there, these little bits of evidence that the Bush administration went to war without any planning and without any idea what they were going to do afterwards.
So this was big news in the UK, where the Times of London carried this.
And where Tony Blair was running for re-election in the UK this last week. His Labour Party was running for more seats in Parliament. And it's interesting, the British people really voted on whether or not they supported the Iraq war. The Labour Party lost nearly 100 seats in Parliament. That's astonishing. They still have the majority in Parliament, so Tony Blair is still in control. However, the fact that he lost almost 100 seats in this last election is a sign that he's not going to be the guy in charge of the Labour Party for very much longer.
But then, sticking with this memo and the coverage here in the U.S., initially I had seen it, Greg Palast had covered it, and because he had done a report for, I believe, BBC Newsnight with this. But otherwise, the Seattle Times, to their credit, carried an article on it.
Yeah, and you know, I didn't see much mention of it in the national press either. I think one of the two major newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, mentioned it but didn't do a very good job of coverage. The L.A. Times did a much better article on it.
So.
And then I also want to talk about, too, that there's some other statistics that might be kind of fun to look at. This week. The war in Iraq, it turns out, is less popular with the American people than we would assume by what the folks on Fox News might be saying. CNN, USA Today, Gallup poll did a survey of Americans that showed that support for the war is at record lows. 57% of the respondents said it was not worth going to war versus 41% who said that it was. Now, that's kind of interesting in itself because that's a 98% response rate, which is really high for polls. It means that people in America definitely have an opinion on the Iraq war. There aren't too many people who aren't paying attention. In a complete reversal on the outcome of the war, 56% of Americans said things were going badly for the U.S. in Iraq. That's up from 45% in March. So there's this complete reversal now where the majority thinks that things are going badly in Iraq and it might be time to leave. And asked whether the U.S. made a mistake in sending troops to Iraq, the response was almost even. 49% said it was a mistake versus 48% who said that it was not. I think that's also maybe a record as well, that you've got almost a majority saying that we should not even have gone. And maybe that's why so few people want to join up with the military and serve in Iraq. The U.S. Army announced this week that it missed its recruiting goals again in April by an astounding 42%. Now, that's the third month in a row that the Army has not been able to make its recruiting goals. And pretty astonishing, considering that the Army hadn't missed a monthly recruiting goal since May of 2000. Things are definitely changing in public attitudes here.
Right. I know that recently they had lowered their threshold for requirements for coming into the military in terms of
who they accept.
Yeah.
And there's some question now if maybe recruiters aren't accepting people who shouldn't qualify at all, even with the lowered standards. And there's been a couple stories of people going through partway through the recruiting process and then getting kicked out because they were mentally ill or had extremely bad criminal records. So, although that hasn't necessarily in the past disqualified the Army from taking people for Vietnam, for example, having really bad criminal records. But in the meantime, Army officials are expecting that they're going to fall short again of their recruiting goals in May. They're expecting that. But nobody really has any plans for how to address that shortfall. Meanwhile, both Japan and Bulgaria announced this week that they're going to be deserting the sinking ship soon by the end of this year when their terms expire, their troop terms expire, and they're not going to be redeploying any troops after December. In the meantime, I think it's helpful that we should look at what they're leaving behind when they're not sending their troops back into Iraq. And it's not because the new government is doing a particularly good job there. The country, for example, is not even close to being rebuilt. The U.S. government has done a really lousy job with reconstruction. A lot of the money that has been spent to build plants and provide equipment has built plants and provided equipment that Iraqi engineers don't know how to operate or maintain. That's something that hasn't been a big story here, but has been a big story in the foreign press, that some of the brand new electrical plants and water plants that have gone online have already deteriorated to the point where the U.S. should probably not have spent the money. The plants that they've rebuilt look just like the plants they replaced because of lack of maintenance and because the Iraqi engineers simply don't know how to operate that type of state-of-the-art equipment. In particular, and also I want to talk about how a lot of the money that should have been spent on reconstruction has gone to train security forces, but they're putting Iraqi troops and Iraqi police officers through something like 5 to 10 weeks of training, when in fact they should be going through a training program that lasts something like 6 months. And then these guys are not going out into a peaceful environment, which is what the training really prepares them for, an environment that's largely peaceful, and they're just doing your routine kind of cop work. They're going out into an environment that is extremely volatile, that is in fact a war, and some folks would say a civil war. Now, what is making folks say that they think this is turning into a civil war is the makeup of the new government. We didn't get much of a chance to talk about this last week, but I did manage to say that the folks who are in all the leading cabinet positions in the new government are returning exiles, folks who have neither any governing experience or much knowledge of the country of Iraq. A lot of these folks, for example, Ahmed Chalabi hadn't been living in Iraq since he was a teenager, you know, for some, 30, 40 years. And now he's in charge. He's a vice president, and he's in charge of the oil ministry. And then there's the actual overall composition of the government. You have Shiites holding the ministries of finance, interior, justice, national security, and 12 other ministries, including Ahmed Chalabi as the acting oil minister. The Kurds hold the foreign ministry and the ministries of trade, planning, water, and public works, and three others. So they have a really strong economic hold on the government. In the meantime, the Sunnis, they hold four ministries. I'm just going to name them. The Culture Ministry, the Women's Affairs Ministry, the Ministry for Provincial Affairs, and the Tourism Ministry. So you can see why there might be some discontent among the Sunni population that they do not have a single major ministry. They have no economic control over the country, and pretty much they're in the ministries. It looks like that they couldn't find anybody to do that work.
Yeah, I think the tourism ministry is probably going to be booming.
Oh yeah. Well, the tourism ministry does have a job, for example, to make sure that archaeological sites are not damaged. However, they can't protect archaeological sites from U.S. troops, like the ones that have been damaged near Babylon by U.S. troop occupation. And the tourism ministry does, in fact, oversee the movement, mostly these days, the movement of Shiite Muslims from Iran into Iraq for certain holy days celebrated in Najaf and Karbala and holy cities like that. It's kind of a farce then to give that ministry over to a Sunni Muslim, when in fact it probably should be a Shiite who is running it. But in the meantime, there are five ministries that are still not filled when the Prime Minister al-Jafari had said that those ministries would probably be filled by this week. They're still vacant. That's the Defense Ministry, Oil Ministry, the Ministry for Electricity, the one for Industry and Minerals, and Human Rights. Now, among those five ministries, two of them are expected to go to a Shiite, the Ministry of Electricity and the Oil Ministry, of course. And currently, you've got a felon, Ahmed Chalabi, running that temporarily, as well as, and the Defense Ministry supposedly is the one big plum that they're supposedly holding for a Sunni. However, this week, what's been holding up the appointment of these five ministers is the fact that the Shiites in control, particularly the returning exile groups like the Dawa Party and the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, these guys cannot agree on a Sunni to run the defense ministry. Every time the Sunni community comes forward with a name, they say, no, 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 he's a Ba'athist. You know, he has some experience in working under Saddam Hussein, so he's totally and completely unacceptable, in spite of the fact that it's going to be really, really hard to find anybody in the Sunni community who has any political experience at all who has not been a member of the Ba'ath Party. It's going to be extremely hard to do that. So this is one reason why we're seeing more and more headlines of suicide bombings and more people dying in Iraq, is because the insurgency is getting more fuel out of the fact that they have absolutely nothing invested in this current government and pretty much no representation. So that may be one of the reasons why Japan and Bulgaria are deserting the sinking ship.
All right. Well, I had seen some articles this week about missing $96 million there.
Yes, that is because the U.S. Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction has been doing a little audit, and he's auditing just one office of reconstruction in Iraq, and that's the office that was based in Hilla to cover the little south-central region of Iraq. So it's not even a complete audit of the reconstruction funds. It's just the audit of one office. What he found is that some $96 to $100 million is totally and completely unaccounted for, and he's fairly sure that at least some of it has been embezzled. Now, this is not U.S. taxpayer money. I should emphasize, this is money that money hasn't even been audited and probably won't be until Congress changes hands and becomes Democratic controlled. instead of Republican controlled. But it's an audit of money that was in the Oil for Food program accounts that the U.S. government was supposed to be overseeing and spending on the behalf of the Iraqi people. That money, $100 million, has gone missing out of one office in charge of disbursing funds. So that gives you some idea of how much of that, of those billions and billions of dollars, may have actually gone into the pockets of U.S. officials instead of to help the Iraqi people. I find that absolutely scandalous. And I think that dwarfs any kind of investigation of the UN Oil for Food Program and how the UN managed the Oil for Food Program accounts.
Okay. And quickly, speaking of investigations, there has been a couple into the Italian journalist.
Yeah, both the U.S. and the Italian government released their reports on the shooting at the roadblock that involved the death of an Italian intelligence agent, Nicola Calipari, and involved wounding Giuliana Sgrena, the Italian journalist that he was rescuing from kidnappers. What they found, and I find this kind of interesting, is both the U.S. report and the Italian report differed a lot in their conclusions. The Italian report particularly scolded the Americans for not preserving any of the physical evidence of what happened. So there was no access to the car. Nobody counted the number of bullets that were fired or what direction they were fired into or at the car. There was no effort to show the position of the car or to preserve any information on where the U.S. troops had positioned any of their vehicles. In addition, portions of the U.S. report had been censored and not released to the public. But when they were posted on the web, a British newspaper was able to pull that document off the web and remove the blacked out coverage of some pieces and then read the censored portions of the report. In the censored portions of the report, it became clear that the U.S. troops who were manning the roadblock had not been adequately trained to run roadblocks in Iraq. In addition, the communications were so bad between the guys running the roadblock and their commanders that the roadblock had been left in place for hours after it should have been taken down and moved. So this whole tragic incident should never have happened, and that really is the fault of the U.S. commanders in Iraq and their communication system. The fact that the roadblocks, the way they're set up and left in place, and the way the troops are trained, should all be changed.
All right. Well,
do we have time for questions?
Well, not really.
Do we have a couple minutes?
We have less than 2 minutes.
Okay, let's go for
it. Well, that doesn't really give us time to get out of here.
I'll try to be fast.
Maria, we were talking last week about 520 and the viaduct. We know the viaduct needs replacement. In fact, Maria had a very early public meeting on the subject. I was told by a paid consultant, Reed PR Hack, that if funding could not be obtained, the structure would not be replaced. Tell me, Maria, what portion and at what location the structure has tilted, and to what degree, and where has it been so damaged that it needs full-on replacement?
The problem is in the Pioneer Square area. The viaduct is tilted considerably, several inches, and I think the number that I've seen is 5 inches at least in that part of downtown, and it's because the soil is not stable in that part of downtown. And they have expected that it would do that over time, and they believe now that the tilting is so far that it's a hazard in an earthquake or even a minor earthquake. Now, the viaduct can either be replaced or it can be rebuilt. I think that's what this person is referring to. And there is still a number of people who would like to see the viaduct rebuilt. But at this point, the cost of doing one or the other is about the same now that they've brought the cost estimate for the tunnel down. I think it's a six of one, half dozen of the other. But the money has to be there and repairs have to be made.
Talking once again with Maria Tomchik, co-editor at Eat the State. And Maria, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places around town where you find free periodicals and newspapers. We can also be found on the web at www.eatthestate.org.